This is a recording that was taken at the North Carolina Biotechnology Conference on 2/17 in Raleigh, North Carolina. The panel was called Financing Trends in Biotechnology. The panel discusses questions such as what are the recent and future trends that investors are seeing in the life sciences sector, how will the investment community and startup companies be affected by the recent economic downturn, what areas will investors focus on to take advantage of the new administration, and what areas should entrepreneurs be focusing on. The moderator was Sean McCarthy, a principal at Pappas Ventures, and the panelists include Fred Frank, vice chairman of Barclays Capital, Michael Baldock, founding partner of Quattro Partners, and Heather Preston, a director at TPG Biotech and TPG Growth LLC.
So I guess the question is there light at the end of this rather gloomy tunnel, or is it really truly different this time? Is this recession going to turn into a depression? What are the implications for all of us in this room who are involved and have been involved for some years in the biotech industry? Well, we have an exceptional panel here today to give us their views, representing both the public and the private side. And I've asked the panelists to kick off with a few introductory comments. Fred Frank will initially talk about a view from the public side and the banking industry, give us his thoughts of some of the turmoil there over the past 6 to 9 months. Michael Baldock will then give us a perspective on M&A and with a recently formed boutique firm called Quattro Partners. I think he's uniquely positioned to give us his perspective. And then we'll move to the private side, where Heather Preston from TPG Ventures in San Francisco will give us her thoughts on what we're seeing in the venture capital community. And if you like, over the course of these three discussions, we'll move backwards from the public to the private space and then run through a number of additional topics. So moving to Fred, who, and thank you again, Vipin, for the introductions. I think Fred really really needs no introduction to all of you in the room. But Fred, over to you. And if I might start off by saying exactly how bad is it out there?
Well, firstly, thank you. Can you all hear me in the back? Now, thank you to the sponsors, and it's my great pleasure to be here to share some thoughts with you during these very challenging times. The topic I was assigned, which is the IPO market, makes for a very short presentation since there is none. So with that, I can turn to my fellow panelists. So I think the question is the IPO market dead, or is it merely lyophilized? And that's really an important question. I will give you one factoid, which is a not very promising one. I have never done the following study accurately because I don't want to do the following study since I already know the answer. And if you take 1980, which many of you recall was the first IPO in the biotech space, which was our friends on the West Coast at Genentech, from 1980 to today, some 29 years, if you take the aggregate investment by the public, exclude the venture capital community, the aggregate investment by the public in biotech, the return is negative. We can't do that forever in a very high-risk industry, which should require higher than normal returns, not negative returns. There are reasons for this. First of all, if we go back in history, the beginning of the biotech industry was with a flawed hypothesis. That hypothesis was that since these are natural molecules, they are safer. Since they are safer, they'll get through the FDA faster. Since they get through the FDA faster, they'll require less investment. History proves that is clearly not correct. They're not safer, they don't get through the FDA faster, and they certainly are not less expensive. So when Cetus went public in 1981 with a remarkable IPO raising $122 million, the expectation was that was the last financing they would ever do. Well, history shows otherwise. They did three R&D partnerships. They did other financings before they went into a merger mode with Chiron. So this is a very capital-intensive industry. In fact, there's no question it is the single most capital-intensive industry in the world, because we all know the time frame from starting a project to becoming commercial. Well, there's many of you will recall a wonderful old movie which was Build It and They Will Come. And it was a fantasy in baseball that some of you may have seen. And I thought it was a very enjoyable movie. And that was really part of the ethos of our biotech industry, was build it and they will come. Well, many years ago, I tried to get young companies to understand sequencing, since you're all in the sequencing business. Because if one went to the IPO presentation of a typical biotech company, the first slide was always the same, which was, our corporate objective is to become a fully integrated pharmaceutical company known as a FIPCO. I would try to suggest that to become a FIPCO, you had to learn to sequence, since you're all in the sequencing business. And the sequence began by being a JITCO, a just-in-time provider of lead compounds and or technology to Big Pharma, which would bring you in enough money that then you could become a RITCO, a royalty income trust company. And once you had enough generation of cash coming in, you could go forward to become a FIPCO. And if you didn't follow the sequence of JITCO to FIPCO, to from RITCO to FIPCO, you would become a SHITCO, and I don't think that's what you all aspire to do. So that's the thing to be very careful about. Now the good news, and there is good news. Let me give you a few statistics. If you take the 100 largest pharma companies and put them over here on the left, my left, and the 100 largest biotech companies and you put them here over on the right, you have the following information. In terms of market cap, the 100 largest pharma companies have 97% compared to 3. In terms of cash, the big guys have 92% against 8. In terms of R&D spend, they have 98 against 2. In terms of products and clinical trials, the big guys have 33, and the little guys, you guys have 67. That is very compelling evidence that there's a natural relationship between big pharma and biotech. And that's where the future is going to evolve. What we've learned is that the pharma companies, in fact, are not good at research, the big guys. They're good at development, they're good at manufacturing, and they're good at marketing. Most of you are very good at research. You're not terribly skilled in terms of differential skills at development or at manufacturing and marketing. So you are truly natural partners. And we have to evolve relationships around that concept. And if one goes back to the original deal between Genentech and Roche, in which I'm very prejudiced since I was the architect, but that was the whole concept basically behind the Roche-Genentech deal, was to maximize comparative advantage. And of course, we're going through an interesting process in that at the moment, but it certainly was very fruitful for both of those parties for many, many years. Now let me give you the next data set, which is extremely important. And if you take the 5 largest pharma companies, plus Amgen, the largest biotech companies, and you make the following assumptions, very simple assumptions. Number one, that between 2005 and 2015, 10 years, that their 05 revenues declined 10%. That's a very conservative figure. That's not 10% per year, that's 10% over the decade. So when Lipitor goes off patent, you're going to lose more than that at Pfizer. The second assumption is their overall growth rate in revenues is 10% per year, probably optimistic. The third assumption is that every product they introduce during this 10 years does $750 million in revenues, probably optimistic. So you take those assumptions and you put them in the Cuisinart and grind them up. You'll come out with the following information, which is very, very important. For Pfizer, the largest company in the industry, to grow at 10% per year, which is their aspiration, with those assumptions, they must introduce 11.58 new products per year, doing $750 million. For GSK, the second largest company, they must introduce 8.9 new products per year, doing $750 million. And you go through the list, you come to Amgen, which is 3.54 new products per year. What are the probabilities of that happening? Zero. I refer to this table when I'm being among friends as the title of this table is NFW. So we have something to learn from that. Now, the next set of data, which I can tell you for which for many years I am now, my batting average is zero. I have a perfect failure rate, which is trying to suggest to the CEOs of all the large pharma companies that one thing they do, which is stupid with a capital S, is their stock repurchase program. As I've explained, they're supposed to be taking a financial asset called cash, converting it into an industrial asset called products, not a financial asset called cash, converting into another financial asset called wallpaper. But that's what they do. Let's look at the results of their stock repurchase program. Take that same limited group of seven companies, and from the period of 1999 to 2006, that group of six companies repurchased $110 billion of their stock in the open market. How well did their stocks do during that period of time? Pfizer's down 49%. Bristol-Myers down 62%, et cetera, et cetera. The only one that was up was Amgen, which was up 15%, which is lower today than it was at the end of that period. So I asked myself, as well as I asked this, so what is the purpose of this stock repurchase program? I said, you're supposed to be converting a financial asset, cash, into an industrial asset called products, and since we have all of you who are capital short and opportunity long, you are truly natural partners. And that's what's going to evolve as we move forward. One other aspect we watch frequently this day and age in the major pharma companies is obviously dramatic cost cutting. But remember, cost cutting does not a product create. Revenues create earnings. Earnings do not create revenues. So by cutting costs to improve their revenues, does not create products, which is the future of this industry. So the future is generating new products serving unmet or poorly met medical needs, and that's why this synchronization of relationship between biotech and pharma will replace the IPO market by and large for creating the capital needed to move these very important products and this very important science to its ultimate fruition.
Thank you, Fred, and that's an excellent segue, I think, into Michael's comments regarding the symbiosis between pharma and biotech and the evolution of this, hopefully, this new market.
Well, so if Fred hasn't given you enough factoids to lead you to slit your wrist, let me help push you over the edge a bit, and then we can come back. It's interesting as we have this discussion. I think there's a lot of yin and yang here, which is all, you know, how can we take what's going on and from this adversity out there, how can we generate some real opportunities for the industry? And I do think that there is going to be a lot of opportunity coming out of once we sort of escape this maelstrom, because if you look back historically in the financial markets, people didn't make money coming out of bull markets. People made money coming out of bear markets. And if you look at venture capital funds, if you look at private equity funds, that's always been the case. So you want to be investing when the markets are down. You don't want to be investing at their peak. So how do we take all this and turn it into opportunity? I think we have a particular problem, and for those of you who were there yesterday, we have some baggage in this industry that we need to figure out how we shed. And it's not that easy, because while investors have short memories, we have a very long time period of creating this baggage, and I think it's going to take a long period to work our way through it. So let me give you a couple more factoids which I've put together, which I've never wanted to do either because I find them very depressing. But if you go back just a couple of years, in November of 2006, a large group of biotech companies that do a financial analysis on a very large group of them were trading, the paid-in capital to market cap ratio was about 118%. So they were effectively, the industry was trading at about the capital that had been invested. So no net creation of value, but no real capital destruction. If you then go back, move up a year to November of 2007, that ratio was 148%. So, you know, it was going the wrong way, still not still not devastating, but going the wrong way. November of 2008, that ratio was 570%. So if you look at the value destruction out there and you sort of say, you know, how do we turn this around? It's a bit like being in a private equity fund. You've got to return to the high watermark before you start making money again. It's a real problem. So I think we need to be realistic about the potential to generate large amounts of capital from the public markets for a while. And that's, you know, there are always exceptions, right? Because there are going to be winners and there are going to be those companies that do well. But I think we need to think more about this industry as a business. Now, that doesn't mean we have to wake up every morning, and because it's not probably what drives most of us, is think about how do we make money for our shareholders and how do we make money for people investing in this business. Most of what drives us is wanting to create, you know, better lives for people, to provide better quality of care, all those great things that people come into this industry to do. But the fact of the matter is, that's not what finances this industry. This industry is financed by and driven by being a business. So I think we need to think more about how we actually do that. And I think one of the ways that's going to evolve over the next couple of years is through the consolidation of assets. And so I hesitate to call it mergers and acquisitions because I think it's going to be a vast array of different things that happen. So we can look at the recent example of Pfizer buying Wyeth. Okay, great. Will there be any more? Sure. Why? Because the companies are disasters, right? I mean, we can talk about the infrastructure in the biotech sector in a second, but those are exercises in rationalization of costs. And I agree with Fred, it doesn't create a lot of extra value. It will create some earnings growth because the fact of the matter is Pfizer and Wyeth don't need the infrastructure they both have. They can operate on probably one. They'll end up operating at about 1.75 because it's so hard to cut those costs, but they can operate on a lot less infrastructure. And I think to draw parallels, and I'll try and do that over the next couple of minutes, you all, the biotech sector, should be thinking about that as well. And I just challenge you, take a random sample of 10 biotechnology companies, pull up their P&L, look at their SG&A line, look at their research line, and ask yourselves, should these companies each be carrying the level of SG&A they are? And the answer is, it's simply no. So I think we have to say to ourselves, we've generated a lot of capital. We're going to have to generate a lot more to actually finance these products. We want to get to the market and make returns. Are we doing it as efficiently as possible? And I think the answer has got to be no. So what has always amazed me is the pharma industry, the big cap guys, who are about as slow as they come and are often accused of not being terribly efficient and accused of many other things, has at least been able to, over time, and we can argue about whether it's been how efficient it's been and how much real value has been created. But they have actually been able to recognize that they're operating inefficiently and have managed to, over time, merge themselves together to at least leverage their infrastructure. And what has always surprised me is that the biotech sector has been unable to really do that. And if you look at the number of biotech companies that have merged that have actually leveraged their own infrastructure, it's very low. And I think the answer is, we were having this conversation this morning, and that is because it's been too easy to raise money. So you didn't have to. You weren't forced to. Now, I think in hindsight, you could say to yourself, well, if I knew I could only raise $100 million as opposed to thinking I could raise $100 every 2 years, I might have spent that $100 million more wisely and maybe didn't need to carry all the infrastructure that I did. But so that's sort of where we are. I think that where we will see the, where we should see the M&A market going over the future is a consolidation of some of the smaller companies to survive, to actually pull together the capital that's there and that's left, to pull together some of the cash flows that people have from royalty streams, and try and put together companies that have larger pipelines where more rational judgments can be made about what money is and isn't spent on. A biotech company with only two products in the pipeline is going to spend like hell to save those two products no matter what and no matter how bad it gets. A biotech company with 8 or 10 may make some more rational decisions. And I think that to draw a parallel between what's happening in the pharma business, I think we need to do that in the biotech industry. I think the only other two comments I'd make on the M&A side, which I think are very obvious, is cash is king. If you look at what's happening in the general market, and it's certainly the case in the healthcare market, the pharma companies, in spite of themselves, are sitting on, if not large cash hoards, significant cash flows. Now, that ain't going to last for long, because to add another very depressing statistic for you, which you've all heard, in the next 7 years, there's $115 billion of revenues going off patent. So if you take Fred's numbers on number of compounds they'd need to create, think about how difficult it is to come up with a $1 billion drug. Think about how difficult it's going to be to come up with $115 billion worth of new drugs over the next 7 years. And by the way, that's not just launching the drugs. That's, you know, revenues that you need to be reaching just for those companies to stay even. So very difficult, but I think, again, creates enormous opportunity. So the pharma companies are going to be out there shopping like mad, and we're seeing it every day, whether it's the big biotech companies, you know, like Cephalon with the option they took recently. There's going to be, I think, a lot of shopping out there for anyone who has cash. Now, it's good news, bad news. I think it's a rescue program. I think they're going to be rescuing assets. I don't think it's going to save a lot of companies in this industry, because the fact of the matter is they're going to be out bargain hunting. Very difficult deals are going to be cut, and deals which on the face of it may look great, but I think if you look at the ratios I gave you and the amount of the market cap to paid in capital, it really is a rescue program, and seeing whether you can salvage some value. So I talked a little bit about yesterday about the Insmed deal, Merck buying their biosimilars business and paying $130 million, of which they're very proud as a company, Insmed. But I just, you know, I pointed out to people yesterday, they actually have spent $340 million over the life of that company, and they've salvaged $123 million after tax. So, and their market cap's 90 with $130 million of cash. So, you know, great rescue program, great for Merck. You know, not necessarily great for investors in the biotech company, and it's certainly probably not the savior of the biotech industry. So I think that we as a group need to figure out how we rescue ourselves, because I think, you know, when we're staring at the pharma companies, they're going to be bringing cash in, but it will be cash to fill their pipelines. So there'll be a great rescue program because they have a lot and they need to rescue us. I think that the rest of the companies that aren't necessarily bought for cheap prices need to take a view at how, you know, how we fix ourselves. I think one of the most interesting transactions going on right now, which, you know, Fred is playing a part in, is the Astellas bid for CV Therapeutics. And I say that because, close your eyes, pretend you're not in this business, and you have investments in the current stock market, which are a disaster, and the market's down 50% over the last year. And the biotech sector is a particular dog, if you look at the analysis, in spite of the fact it's performed a little better in the last few months than the general market. And for one of your portfolio companies, you are offered 100% premium in cash. Okay, and you think about the general market, you look at the history of how this sector is traded and the volatility, and as a shareholder, is that a great deal? In the context of all your other holdings in this sector, is it a winner from a shareholder's perspective? Is it a winner from a company's perspective? Is it a winner from the big cap pharma's perspective? But look at the dynamic that's going on right now in terms of one's view or the company's view and what that company is actually worth, and remember who owns the company, and remember who's, you know, buying the shares in the company and why they're buying those shares, and it's a money-making exercise. And I think the outcome of that will be very interesting, because I think we will see more and more pharma companies out trying to buy these assets and offering cash premiums, and I think the boards are going to have to look long and hard at themselves when they sit there and say, you know, this company is not worth, 200 times my market cap.
So with the, thank you, Michael, with the IPO market assuredly closed for the foreseeable future, and with this, substantial need on the side of pharma, but significant buying opportunities. Heather, how is the venture side looking at, from two perspectives, existing companies, and what advice are you giving them, and how are you thinking about new investments in this environment?
Sure. Well, I thought actually I'd start by saying a little bit about one element of the business that most of us don't think about at all, which is the limited partners for the venture capital funds. So these are the university endowments, the pension funds, the sovereign funds who invest their capital in the venture capital funds in the first place. So, and they're not often seen, particularly by you in the audience, but they drive a lot of the decision-making being made within venture capital firms. So most of these limited partnerships are invested across all industry segments and across every possible means of investing, whether it's equity, debt, structured financing, through real estate to every industry sector. And so what we're seeing in the current market is, even though things may feel pretty bad in healthcare and in biotech, it's a lot worse in some of the other industry sectors. And so the limited partners are not receiving capital back at the moment and haven't been for the last year and aren't sure when they are going to be. So what are they saying to their venture capital funds, particularly in the biotech sector? Well, it's two things. It's firstly, don't call capital. We don't have the capital which we committed to you available. In order for us to provide you capital, we'd have to liquidate other investments that are obviously underwater. So go slow. So that is, and we're hearing that from LPs of all sizes and of all nationalities. So that's the first thing. The second is, they, like us, the general managers, are very worried about how to support the investments they've already made. You know, we may, you know, as most venture capital funds are structured as 10-year funds. So we may have companies we invested in 8, 9, even 10 years ago, let alone investments we made in 2006, where you developed a budget based on the assumption one would be able to raise additional rounds of capital. Well, as we've heard, the IPO market isn't there, and the venture capital funds are very reluctant to invest. So for our current portfolios, the options available to raise the additional capital they need to advance their programs is getting increasingly challenging, and the LPs are worried about that because they don't want to have been supporting a company for 8 years and then not be able to get it over the finish line to a point that pharma may be interested, as an example, in acquiring the company. So they're very worried about, have you reserved adequately to continue supporting your investments? And if you haven't, how are you going to do that? Are you going to ask for cross-fund investments, i.e. come back to us or potentially to one of the group of LPs for a later fund and ask them to support your investments in earlier stage funds? LPs hate doing that for a number of reasons, not least of which the concern that they may be, that one group of LPs may be supporting less successful investments that another group of LPs have been backing. So that's the voice that venture capital is hearing. It's not what you hear, but that's what we hear. Go slowly and figure out a way to finance your companies and get them. Don't come back to ask us for additional capital to support them. The other issue that the limited partners are also facing is they generally have an asset allocation between public, their investments in the public market and those in the private. The public markets are obviously much better at marking to market and than we are on the private side, and hence the value of their public portfolios often looks worse than that of their private portfolios, at least in the short term. So their allocations are out of whack. It looks like they've overinvested in private, in venture capital firms and other forms of private equity. So as venture funds go back to their LPs to raise new funds, their LPs are saying, sorry, we can't make any more investments in private equity firms. So I think what we're going to see is a contraction in the venture capital industry overall. A number of funds who exist today are not going to be able to raise subsequent funds. And that obviously is going to have a significant implication for the funding of early stage companies. So in answer to Sean's question, what are we doing with our current investments? We're all very focused on trying to extend the runway and try and avoid our companies going out into the market to raise financing as long as possible. Certainly through 2010, if possible through 2011, that obviously isn't always possible, but I'd say through certainly every single company in our portfolio, we've gone through an exercise to cut programs that we don't think will be value creating in the short term, to reduce headcount, anything we can possibly do to extend runway. Part of that is because the valuations, as you all know, that you see when you go out and try and raise money, even in the public markets, are brutal. Everybody's looking for a great deal. And so 50% down rounds, 75% down rounds. That is not uncommon today. In fact, most of us joke that a flat round is the new up round. What you're seeing is for those companies that are fortunate enough to have investor syndicates with deep pockets and adequate reserves, we're seeing a lot of insider rounds being done. Let's just get through that value creation point. Why go out into the market and have our ownership wiped to nothing if we can possibly avoid it? But for those of you sitting on the side of management, the terms of those insider loans are often pretty egregious as well. I'm sure we'll talk about this some more later in the panel, but any means of getting non-dilutive capital into the companies, whether that's through government grants, through foundation funding, through partnerships with pharma, that's been a major effort. And so what are we seeing on the new investing side, just in brief, as I'm also sure we'll discuss this in more length? A number of venture firms have focused primarily on later stage companies as well as public companies that have been pretty beaten up in the market, as they see a lot of opportunity to get late stage assets at an early stage price today. However, that isn't all. Not all groups. A lot are sticking to their knitting, continuing to invest in early stage as well as late stage.
Thanks, Heather. And I'd like, if there is time, or maybe this will come up in Q&A, to visit alternative exit strategies that may emerge, or actually would by necessity need to emerge from the current market over the next few minutes. But before we get into that area, perhaps on a more optimistic note, and looking to the future, looking at the public markets again, it's certainly the case that there are certain sectors in healthcare and in biotech in particular that appear to have stood up really quite well in the face of this downturn. And one area that I would cite is the genomic molecular diagnostic arena. If you look at genomic health or Genoptix, these two companies have both sustained valuations in the $600 million range really throughout this turbulence. So is that one area that could potentially be of interest, or are there other areas, maybe Fred, starting with you, given that the public market seems to be in such a funk right now in terms of what they're really valuing, where are good areas to begin to think about forming new businesses?
Well, perhaps a little history. If one goes back to BC, my time, which stands for before computers, it was very interesting that the pharma companies, as you know them, were all relatively diversified, all at Johnson & Johnson. But as time went on, they basically all divested all their non-RX operations. But let's fast forward and look at the companies who have done the best, the pharma companies, over the last few years. Who are they? They're Johnson & Johnson, it's Roche, and it's Abbott. These are the diversified companies. So you're seeing now, when I deal with those large pharma companies, more interest in reviewing what's the future going to be. And clearly the relationship between diagnostics and pharma is becoming increasingly important, because when we head towards the world of proteomics, the right drug for the right patient at the right time in the right dosage form, that requires a diagnostic approach to prescription pharmaceuticals. So I think we're going to see a lot more, as John was talking about, of this world which borders diagnostics and pharmaceuticals. Those happen to be two companies which I'm very familiar with since we took them public. But I think that they are setting kind of a standard, because the other thing, which you all know very well, is they're faster to market for products. And that's extremely important, because it means they're less capital intensive, and they can get to positive revenues and positive earnings relatively quickly, and that obviously resonates very well with investors. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that interface between the pure biotech and these enabling technology companies as we go forward.
So perhaps building on that a little bit, and looking to the again, thinking about new areas for the audience to be considering. With the advent of the Obama administration, what areas would you see as being important strategically moving forward that could provide interest to venture capitalists and the public markets alike? And Heather, perhaps you'd like to comment first on that.
So I certainly agree with your and Fred's comments earlier that personalized diagnostics companies that are quick to revenue and profitability will be of particular interest. I think another area, and one we've certainly made an area of focus, is pharmaceutical outsourcing businesses. As we're seeing pharma kind of focus on their knitting, not feeling that they need to own and build themselves every component of the value chain, API manufacturers, CROs, et cetera, that not only pharma are dependent on, but also biotech, are other areas that we've seen being relatively robust in this market. In particular relevance to the Obama initiatives in healthcare, there is a lot of capital going to be forwarded towards the development of an electronic medical record system. This has been tried in for the last 15, 20 years in various incarnations, but never with this amount of capital specifically from the government being put behind it. So I think it'll be interesting to see that. I expect that area will blossom with numbers of new companies trying to take advantage of that. And then the other one point I'd make, and this again is not specific to the administration, but comes back to the relationship between biotech and pharma, is pharma continues to look for innovation. And I think that is not going to change in this marketplace. The pharma pipelines are abysmal, and they know they have to solve that. And so I think we will continue to see venture capital investing in novel therapies, because at the end of the day, those are the something new and big is what pharma pays for. They do not pay for the Me Too products that for a number of years were quite popular to invest in, because they were, specialty pharma was considered a safer option, lower risk for venture capitalists. But I think that we're not seeing venture capitalists being paid for investing in that area to the same extent today.
Sean, if I can pick on something on that point. Go back in your memories to 1976, an important demarcation year. That was the year of the introduction of cimetidine, the first blockbuster drug from SmithKline Beecham, as then known. If you take the period, and I think if you look at pharma, it's very important to realize we've been through three distinct periods. 1950 to 1976 was normal. Pharmaceutical stocks sold at discounts to the industrial averages in terms of P/E ratios. 1976 to 2000 is the second demarcation point, and that's the period of blockbusters. So as I said, the first blockbuster drug was cimetidine, followed by a series of drugs. And if we examine the blockbuster drugs, what you will find out is most of them, not all of them, but most of them were fast follower drugs. They were not first in class. They may have been best in class, but they were clearly not first in class. Take ranitidine followed by Prilosec. Cimetidine was $1 billion product, ranitidine was $3 billion product, and Prilosec was $6 billion product. They were maybe best in class, they were certainly not first in class. So most of these were fast follower drugs, which was much easier to do. Now as we go forward, let me go back to 2000, why was that a demarcation point? Because that's the first year in which the aggregate sales of blockbuster drugs were down from the prior year, because obviously we started having patent expirations. So now you have a new world that we're entering because of the reimbursement side. It's going to be much harder to get reimbursement for a best-in-class as opposed to a first-in-class, if the first-in-class is now off patent and can be prescribed generically. So now what's happened when people look at the pharma stocks, which are now selling once again at discounts to the industrial averages in terms of P/E ratios. In fact, this is a return to normal. the abnormal period was the interval in before because of all these fast follower drugs. So I think this brings up the point that was just made, was that in the biotech world, what you all are working on, you're basically working on first-in-class drugs. And that's where the market's going to really resonate very strongly with big pharma, because it's going to be so much harder to get reimbursement, adequate reimbursement, for maybe best-in-class, but the payor community can say, well, look, you don't need the little purple pill. You go to the drugstore and get Zantac. If that doesn't work, we'll think about prescribing the little purple pill for you. So Crestor ain't going to happen the way we saw it before. So we're in a very new world, and I think the adjustment to the new world, frankly, is very positive to bio vis-a-vis pharma.
I think those comments could spawn a whole new panel, of course, leading into impact of generics, impact of biosimilars, the fact that pharma has been getting into this space, a rapidly evolving and rather complex space. But and I certainly have a long list of additional questions here, but rather than go down that list, I'd like to, in our last 15 minutes, open this up to the floor for questions for our panel. I don't know if we have microphones in the room, but you may have to just speak loud, and I'll repeat the question.
Just a general question to the panel. Yesterday there were I had a trial number from GSK. The issue of comparative effectiveness, how would you see general investment flows for your side, given that that is likely to become a reality in some way, shape, or form within the next 5 to 10 years? How would you anticipate the investment flows going into shots on goal, or when you have to prove that you are really going to make it in the bigger environment versus what we have been doing last year?
So the question, for those of you at the back, the question pertains to the timing of this evolution that Fred was alluding to, of pharma needing to prove value with novel therapies as opposed to more follow-on type of modalities, if I got the question.
Well, I think one observation, most of you probably saw recently, where Pfizer dropped a phase 3 product. And obviously they spent a lot of money on it. Why did they drop it? Because it wasn't working? No. It was an effective drug, but it was no more effective than those on the market. So that, I think, gives you a sense of where big pharma is going. And I think as we parse through that, it goes back to the point that I was making, that I think you're going to see a lot more of the R side of pharma being spent with biotech. And if you look at the numbers, they're very clear that the percentage today of R spent with biotech versus internal research is quite high. It varies by companies, but it is increasing pretty much across the board, and to where in some cases it's close to 50-50. And I think that's the trend that we're going to see, because those are the first-in-class drugs for the future. And I think the Pfizer example is quite real.
I'd make one quick point, which I think from the venture capital perspective, I think that'll change what we do on the margin, since most of what we're doing is novel mechanism of action, and we are trying to finance to a proof of concept as opposed to defining exactly where in the marketplace an agent might be used. I think from the point of view of most early stage venture backed companies, we're just trying to get over that first hurdle and show that we have a drug that is efficacious and safe in small numbers of patients. We're then leaving it to our either large biotech or large pharma partners subsequent to that to define the relative effectiveness. Now, obviously, there are, especially in very crowded therapeutic areas, where there's no point even starting unless you believe your novel mechanism will result in some differentiable attribute of that asset, and you'll have to demonstrate it early. There are obviously those cases, but I'd say they're the minority compared to where we're generally playing.
I think you raise a very interesting point. And I can't prove the statement I'm about to make for you, but by observation, and since I've been doing this for 51 years, I've had a lot of chance to observe. When we bring to a major pharma company a licensing acquisition of a drug, You know, they're very professional. They look at it. They then put a team together to analyze it, and both from the marketing point of view and a science point of view. The marketing point of view is pretty straightforward. The science is more complicated. And my experience has been, my observation be, when we bring an opportunity to Big Pharma and they look at it, they raise the bar up to this level in terms of the science. The science on their own products is about here, in my observation. If they would equalize it, I think they would cancel half of their internal projects. But that's very hard to do. But I think in the future, we're going to see a lot more of that take place. And because, again, the need to be first in class as well as best in class. So I think this equalization factor will turn out to be very beneficial to the biotech community.
I would imagine there are one or two representatives from pharma in the audience, but I wanted to invite you to comment on that. So other questions? In the back there. Yeah.
Michael Merkham with Paragon here, and we're a personalized diagnostic. To what extent would the economic climate and investment climate cause biotechs and pharma to bring back or repurpose drugs that may have been put on the shelf because of lack of efficacy, which can now be combined with any diagnostics? Do you guys think that that would, that this combined would cause them to do that, or basically move away from the blockbuster technology?
So the question is, with the advent of improved techniques for diagnostics, might pharma revisit repositioning certain compounds, taking, I guess, theranostic type of approaches? Heather, why don't you kick that one off?
I guess I'll take that. I'm not sure we're going to succeed. I think that is a move we've been seeing over time, over the last 5 to 10 years, and I think we will continue to see a trend there. I don't think based on, I think the magnitude of pipeline problems in pharma are so immense, I'm not sure that they're just going to be looking on the shelf for what other products they have sitting there. I actually think most of their focus is going to be looking externally. Also, in following up to Fred's point, there are well-documented studies showing that the success of an in-licensed compound the odds of it getting to market is much higher for an in-licensed compound than an internally generated one within pharma. But I think the theranostic approach will be one that's used, but I don't think we're going to see suddenly pharma going through the whole of their cabinets trying to find what else they've got in there.
I do think this looking for compounds that can be restructured, if you will. I've long observed that the worst word in the English language is the word failure. And I've tried to educate my young son, when he was young, he's now 15, but when he's young, that failing is not falling down, failing is not getting up. And I think we've created this word failure in clinical trials, which has devastating effect on stock prices. As you announced the product had a failure in phase 2 trials or phase 1 or phase 3, whatever it was, the stocks get devastated. But in fact, these clinical trials are experiments in which you learn. So if you look at Avastin, which is obviously an extremely successful, important product, it, quote, failed 3 times before Genentech figured it out. So we've got to get out of our vocabulary this word failure and understand more about clinical trials, what we learned, are they really going to be on the pathway to something? So I think I think there will be an opportunity to look at a lot of compounds and reposition these compounds as we go forward in the future, and I think we'll see quite a bit of that.
And the good news is there's a rebasing going on right now in the pharma industry. We have gone through this period where there were some areas which lent themselves to chronic use by a huge population base where the pricing could be quite high. And for instance, it's driven the cash flows of these companies and the market price of these companies and the PE multiple of these companies to outrageous highs. And there's a rebasing going on right now. So the fact is, I think once you go through this exercise that the pharma companies are going through right now, which Pfizer and Wyeth are going to go through, which is, you know, they are going to have to adjust the size of the company and the infrastructure of the company for a company that's got 30% less revenues. It can still be very profitable. And the fact is, the reality is a company with 30% less revenues properly structured can be a great driver of innovation, can be a great generator of cash flow, and is probably better equipped to look at and target much more interesting, comparably effective products than they were historically, where they were literally looking for the next $5 to $10 billion product. So I think that the good news is from the perspective of the biotech sector, is it's readjusting itself, where innovation is going to become much, much more important, and I think drive a lot of what was going on out there in the research front.
Yes, right at the back there. So the question is, are you seeing, or to what extent we're seeing trends in the service area, particularly as it relates to pharma and pharmaceutical services, I would think. Yeah.
There's more and more outsourcing going on. There's a lot more outsourcing going on, certainly. And I think one of the things that we've seen over the past, although not as much as one might think, but I think we will see more of, which is as these companies try to restructure themselves, they start spinning out big chunks of their current business, which become outsourced players. So I guess the interesting dynamic is that just postponing an inevitable issue, or will they create new dynamic companies which can go out and literally take chunks of infrastructure for one company that has the capacity to serve as the same provider to 10 companies and leverage up that infrastructure by hiving it off. And we're seeing that. We've already seen it on the manufacturing front as we've had a consolidation where they've hived off the manufacturing plants and literally gone from manufacturing one pill for one company to manufacturing, five-plus product for multiples. And I think we'll start to see that on the development side more and more. And so I think it's inevitable as these guys try to bring their costs down and adjust to their new revenue bases.
Well, here in North Carolina, you're in the heartland of the CRO industry, and you're seeing that very dramatically. You saw some of the big pharma companies are actually now outsourcing all that business to CROs, and I think you'll see more of that as we go on. As I said right here, you're very much the center focus of the CRO industry here in North Carolina.
I'd make two additional points. I think the area, so referring specifically to the CROs, I think the part of the marketplace we're seeing that's holding up in the most robust fashion is the players of real scale, mainly focused on late stage, on phase three and phase four commitments. I think where the marketplace is becoming a lot more competitive is on the preclinical and phase one, early phase two area. I think there's been an explosion in the amount of outsourcing, and as a result now we're seeing a lot of the cost pressures happening in that part of the market. And I think even earlier stage, I think API manufacturers, early medicinal chemistry, and CROs, we're again seeing a lot more competition there, primarily ex-US, India and China. And I think that's where we're going to see a lot of consolidation in the marketplace. But certainly to date, I think where we're seeing the outsourcing industry stay most robust is the few but real scale players who can maintain quality and are really, there are very few people that Big Pharma can go to for those very, very large contracts.
Yeah, but in terms of outsourcing the CRO work, Big Pharma would appear to want to work with CROs who are global in nature, who can run clinical trials around the world. And those companies happen to be the big U.S. CROs. So there are good CROs in India, for example, but they are basically India-centric. Whereas if you look at Quintiles and PPD and Covance, for example, they're truly global players of CROs. So they can run the trials on a global basis, and I think that's what's going to be a major competitive advantage.
I think to the degree that on the investment side, certainly on the venture side, that we've been looking at service plays, certainly something that we're considering seriously in this market. I think one has to, the question always is how one thinks about returns on models like that, and that's an active debate certainly within our firm. I think we have time for one more question. I know we have a lunch scheduled at 12:30, which we'll want to get to promptly, so maybe in the back over there.
Yeah, Mark Kidner, BioBilly. What about biomanufacturing or contract manufacturing? Do you see that as a viable business going forward? You're talking about R&D, drug development, working with large pharma, et cetera. What about making the product?
So the question is, when you say biomanufacturing, are you referring specifically to biologics? Or?
Well, biologics for this meeting, contract manufacturing.
Yeah. So the question is investment opportunities or, I guess, the viability of that business from an investment standpoint in the current climate.
Well, I think it is viable because a lot of the small biotech companies who will come up with creative products in terms of the R side and the D side, the manufacturing is a very, very big challenge. And it's not economic for every small biotech company to put in biological manufacturing capability. It's too expensive. It's too complicated. The approval cycles are very difficult. So I think that that's going to be an important aspect of the interface between all these sectors in biotech and pharma.
Well, with that, I think I'd like to draw this panel to a close. Thank you to the audience. And thank you.